She says, look, we are living in a time when so many people are looking for their identities, are looking for a simpler, you know, gentler way of life. Then the Islamic State comes along and says, look, we can build something new together, something fresh together, something new, but also something that harkens back to the days that we've always been told are the most beautiful days in Islam, the days of the Prophet Muhammad. That's a pretty seductive potion right there.
Welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Daum. My guest this week is journalist Carla Power. In 2017, Carla published If the Oceans Were Ink, An Unlikely Friendship and Journey into the Heart of the Quran, which chronicled her friendship with a madrasa-trained sheikh and religious scholar who led her through a deep reading of the Quran. That book was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. In her new book, Homeland Security, De-Radicalization and the Journey Back from Extremism, Carla, an American who spent large parts of her childhood and adolescence in countries like Afghanistan, India, and Egypt, confronts some of the questions she hadn't engaged with in her last book, namely, what draws ordinary Muslims into violent extremist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and how reliable are the roads back? Through dozens of interviews with ex-jihadis, their family members, and those who seek to rehabilitate them, Carla connects the dots of a constellation of reasons and motivations to join extremist groups. The patterns that emerge are both surprising. In one case, an entire extended family was lured by the promise of a better life in the Islamic State, and all too familiar. Social media plays a role, no surprise. Carla spoke with me about what her reporting taught her about human loneliness, cultural isolation, youthful impressionability, and most of all, how what's commonly referred to as the Islamic world is in fact many worlds, each with their own characteristics and complications. Carla Power, welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Your new book, Homeland Security, I'm sort of tempted to put it under the category of geopolitical psychology, if there is such a thing. I might have just made that up. In it, you ask the question of many different people in many different ways of what draws somebody into a violent extremist group. And here the focus is on Islamic radicalism and what can bring somebody back from that. But before we get to that question, I want to touch on a brief anecdote from your introduction, and that pertains to your previous book, which I also want to touch on a bit. You talk about having drinks with a friend who works in national security for her country, and she says, you're not going to give me that pat line about Islam being a religion of peace again, are you? So why don't you start by saying how you have come to a place where you find yourself in this role as a kind of, not cultural, at least intellectual ambassador to Islam from the West?
Oh my goodness. I don't know if I would consider myself that, but I've always been interested in how the West sees the Muslim world, or there is no Muslim world, but Muslim societies, and what sort of preconceptions and prejudices go into that. This partly comes from having grown up partly in the Midwest and partly in pretty much every country that was later toppled by a coup: Iran, Afghanistan, India, Egypt. And so I sort of shuttled between being sort of feeling like an outsider in the Midwest and being an expatriate in these countries. And so I got very interested in what goes into our images of the Muslim world. And as you say, that was very much a basis for If the Oceans Were Ink, where I sort of sat and had a listening exercise with a sheikh who had very different worldviews from mine, and trying to find common ground there. So after that, when after that book came out and a lot of people were saying, you know, what about Islamist terrorism? How do you explain that? And this friend of mine who said, you know, yes, you know, you're not going to give me that old line again. But in fact, I kind of was. I kind of didn't want to examine the role of Islam in extremism and sort of decided to keep lockstep and say, well, it's so much better to amplify the vast majority, which is peaceable and flexible and pluralistic. I just found it so much easier to say, well, you know, that's a tiny minority and they aren't really Muslim and they're wildly perverting Muslim texts, and try to ignore it and say, you know, look over here, you know, the Indians had this amazing multicultural and flexible, you know, empire, and look at how great the Ottomans were. And then it occurred to me that was kind of a liberal's version of shutting down any conversation on violent extremism that was wrapping itself in Islam. And I decided to sort of face the music and listen to people who had been drawn into it and their families to try to figure out what was going on and what the appeal could be.
You start close to home, at least you start there in the book. You start in the UK, you go to Birmingham to meet a woman named Nicola, whose son Rashid had run away to join ISIS. Why don't you tell us who she is? First of all, how you found her. How do you even approach somebody like this? Where does it all begin?
Well, it was very, very hard back in 2017 when I started reporting this to find people who were willing to speak. And among the very few parents and particularly and mothers who wanted to speak was Nicola, who had given an interview to the BBC. And I approached her through an organization that helps parents who worry about their children being radicalized, and went up to Birmingham really expecting wondering what, you know, the mother of an ISIS fighter would be like. And, you know, for all my years of sitting around trying to deconstruct Orientalist stereotypes and for all my knowledge of how, you know, there was a wide range of folks who were going over there, I still expected a woman in a black burqa, very stern and very pious. And of course, the woman who meets me at Birmingham train station clips along in stiletto heels and has pearls and, you know, a diamante brooch fixing her hijab. Nicola was a convert from Wales, and her son was very young when he began to be concerned about Muslim kids over in Syria, and, you know, got quite excited that there was now a caliphate that he could go to. And one morning she woke up and he was gone.
How old was he at that time?
He was 18, I believe. 18 or 19, actually 19 when he left. And, you know, they weren't a particularly overtly pious family. I mean, they were pious, but they weren't, you know, militant by any means. And, you know, it was heartbreaking watching her sort of try to pace back over the past and try to see the signposts for Rashid going over there. And, you know, there were little things that in, you know, with 2020 hindsight, she could see, you know, he began growing his hair longer, or he told his dad he didn't want to go to the same mosque that the whole family had always gone to. And he wanted to go to a mosque that was sort of younger and edgier across town, not edgier, but certainly had
more hardcore.
More hard, had a reputation for being more hardcore. And, but talking to her, you know, I had expected, you know, the beetle-browed guys we have seen on the television news at ISIS. I mean, really scary commando types. And instead, what I came away with is an image of a Peter Pan, you know, this really young kid who was tremendously idealistic and didn't quite know what he was getting into and went over there and, you know, got recruited effectively. Now, you would say, oh, a mother would say this, wouldn't she? But, you know, she's quite clear-eyed that he should come home and face, you know, she wanted him to come home. She knew he would go to jail. She knew he did wrong. But, you know, at the same time, some of the details she told me about him were just heartbreaking. I mean, he was so naive that he actually called her to ask whether he could go on his commander's motorcycle. And she was like, okay, but as long as you're wearing, you know, a helmet, you know. Yeah,
that was an incredible detail. So he's actually being trained to be a killer, a jihadi, and yet at the same time, he is seeking his mother's permission to ride on a motorcycle. I'm hoping you can explain, like, do you know actually what kind of training goes on in these camps, in these establishments? What is likely to happen to somebody like Rashid when he first arrives there? Because I have to say, I was struck by, in a lot of these cases, that these young people were communicating with their families. Like, you imagine these guys going away to train to be fighters and are never heard from or seen again. Like, the idea that they would be phoning home, it had never crossed my mind.
That's interesting. I guess a lot of times, I mean, she had to wait like 12 weeks to hear from him.
Right.
Because he went, you know, the one family that I spoke to in detail about the arrival process was an Indonesian family where they talked to me about how instantly the men were taken away for training and indoctrination. And apparently that is what happened was if you went as a family or as a, you know, the women who went were taken one place and the men would go off for jihadi training. And it's interesting because Nicola was warned that he would be, you know, there would be certain signposts along the way where he would be more and more distant from her. She got very close with another mother who I also interviewed named Christiane, who is working with a German de-radicalizer, Daniel Kohler, and together they're trying to help parents sort of cope with what happens when their kids are abroad. And they said, you know, when you see when Rashid goes off for his first battle after training, he's going to be very distant. And strangely enough, he wasn't at all. He was needier and wouldn't let Nicola off the phone. But yeah, these guys are taken off and trained and their passports are taken away. And I think their phones were often taken away during training, but I'm not sure. But I do know that he couldn't call for 12 weeks.
Okay. And yeah, I do want to talk with you in some depth about what you might imagine the psychological profile of this kind of young person is. And especially in the case of the family, I think they were from Jakarta that you mentioned. I really want to talk about them because that's an incredible case. But before we get to that, let's, for instance, talk about Christiane. So who was her son? How did this all transpire in her family?
Christiane is a Canadian accountant who was raised Catholic and is a Catholic, whose son had a rather troubled childhood, incredibly bright and bored at school, and had witnessed domestic violence and his parents' breakup and went into a deep depression. And a couple of years into it, embraced Islam, which Christiane thought was a good thing. She really hoped it would give him purpose and meaning and some sort of spiritual connection. But he as the years went on, got angrier and angrier. He started going to a particular Quranic study circle. And, you know, he would be increasingly angry at the family. You know, when she served alcohol at the table, he would get up and leave. He would take phone calls outside. And, you know, this kid was brilliant, very high IQ. And when he said he wanted to go off to be an Islamic scholar and study in Egypt, you know, he was no longer a kid. He was in his 20s by then.
And this was in Canada, just so
this is in Canada. Yeah, this is from Calgary. Yeah.
And did he or anyone in the family have ethnic ties to the Muslim world, or was he just
none whatsoever? No,
white kid from white Canadian kid.
He was a white Canadian kid, absolutely raised a Catholic, and yeah, so no ties. But I mean, the proverbial zeal of the convert is. Yeah. You know, there it has been noticed that converts tend to have there tends to be a higher proportion among them in these violent extremist groups. So in that sense, and he went to Syria, and he would communicate with Christiane by phone or on Facebook, but he was killed in battle. And Christiane then sort of turned it around and became a counselor to counsel other families as part of a way to process her grief.
And she ends up living in Toulouse, right? You're traveling to France? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah. I mean, she, you know, Christiane's story was very much an index of how sort of the trauma of these situations can spread throughout families. She had trouble finding a job because she had spoken out quite publicly to newspapers about her situation. And she couldn't understand why she couldn't get a job as an accountant. And finally, someone in HR said to her, look, you know, when they Google you, they see is that you're a mother of a terrorist. And so she decided to move over to France with her parents and took her then 12-year-old son. And I think they're back in Canada now, but they needed to go over there for a while to regroup. And she ran counseling from France, fielding calls from worried parents all over the world during the Islamic State.
So at this point in your reporting, were you feeling like you were recognizing patterns? Because in some ways, these stories, they sound similar to the stories you hear about any kind of kid getting involved in a cult or becoming a white supremacist or just kind of getting completely sucked into a destructive, potentially dangerous, violent subculture. Was there something in particular about Islamic extremism that kind of pushed the buttons of these particular kids in this particular way?
Well, I mean, I do think one of the things I really wanted to investigate was for 20 years now, this has been presented as a kind of existential threat. You know, the Islamist terrorist is seen as this boogeyman that stands apart from anything else that could go on. And of course, the more I talk to people, you're absolutely right. The more it became clear that this isn't for, especially for very young kids in the West, you know, this is often not very different from other trans, you know, youthful teenage transgressions. It just has much bigger political and criminal consequences.
Well, and the level of organization is on a whole other level. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Well, a level of what organization?
Being organized. It's not like somebody can decide, I want to be a white supremacist and then join some kind of global organization that has some kind of mobilized effort.
Well, there's certainly a
construction.
Right. There's certainly a mobilized effort to recruit these kids. that is, and I think the same is true of white supremacists. You know, you get a kid online who seems kind of vulnerable or lonely, looking for friends, and you start messaging them, and then you suggest a cup of coffee. And I mean, in terms of a pattern, I would say, first off, every story is different. That there are so many different reasons that these kids end up joining these groups. And so I would say that on the one hand. On the other hand, the patterns pushing them in, you know, it's often belonging. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for transcendence. They're looking for adventure. And very often someone is, you know, preying on them, is trying to recruit them, exploiting, you know, these yearnings. And so it's a two-way street in that sense. In terms of it being a special thing for Islamist militants, I actually think I found real connections with other extremist groups, with, as you say, with cults. There are all sorts of things that we don't sort of box off in this way that we have Islamist extremism that are equally tantalizing to the teenage brain at this particular point when you're hardwired to seek adventure and belonging and thrills.
Do you have any numbers or does any data exist with respect to how many people get recruited into these groups every year, say, how many are in them? Like, it just in terms of proportion, I want to try to get a sense of what we're looking at.
Well, it depends on where you're looking. I mean, the book was very much kind of, you know, snapshots of various countries and with it, various reasons for people going in. At the height of the Islamic State, there were, I believe, 50,000 foreign, well, there are now 50,000 foreign fighters still waiting to come home, I believe. But it really depends, you know, it was an ad hoc thing in terms of locality, in terms of how organized people were, in terms of networks. It absolutely varies. I don't have any over, you know, I'm sure places like the Soufan Institute, or people who are doing a data analysis would have much better figures.
And when you say 50,000 foreign fighters waiting to go home, who are you talking about and where are they and what homes are they waiting to return to?
At the height of the Islamic State, there were about 40,000 foreign fighters from around the world, from about 110 countries who had joined to fight. And you know, since the Islamic State was defeated as an area, some have gone home. Many were killed and some were disillusioned. A lot were, you know, a lot lost the thrill once they hit the reality of the battlefield. There are about 64,000 women, mostly women and children, refugees sitting in camps in northern Syria now. And countries are trying to decide whether or not to take them back. You know, the Russians have taken them back. The Russians have taken, you know, there've been a lot of kids born during the Islamic State. Do you take the kids back? Russia had this program where they took them back and put them back with their grandparents. We've taken a few back, but there have been some real hardline decisions about that. So, for example, in the UK where I live, there was a very high profile case of Shamima Begum, who joined as a 15-year-old schoolgirl and went off and is now sitting in a resettlement camp and petitioned last year to come back and face trial. She wanted to, but the Home Secretary here stripped her of her British citizenship, saying, she was, I believe, born in Bangladesh, but is a British citizen. And so she's sort of been cast into the outer darkness. She can't even come home for a trial. under British law.
And was she actually fighting?
No, she wasn't. I mean, the women by and large were, you know, doing, you know, they were seen as, you know, reproducers of the next generation.
See, this is something I want to understand. So one of the most remarkable stories in your book involves a family in Jakarta, I mentioned a little bit ago, who were drawn into ISIS by their teenage daughter, who got seduced through Tumblr accounts. So ISIS recruiters had set up accounts basically telling people that they could pay off their debts, get medical treatment, even go to medical school. Even if they joined, they were promising people this good life. And this family, because of their daughter's influence, their teenage daughter's influence, ended up selling their house and moving to Syria. So tell us about these folks.
Well, they were fascinating because, you know, I remember back in the 90s when I, you know, reporting out of Pakistan, and everybody was like, okay, poverty is the reason for radicalization. You know, these kids go to these jihad schools and they get indoctrinated. And that was partly true, but certainly not in the case of this family, who were upper middle class. The father was a high-level civil servant. And, you know, they were leading lovely lives, going to play tennis and play at the mall. And this then 16-year-old, who I call Afifa, tremendously bright and leading a kind of dull suburban life. There were a number of Tumblr accounts by women designed to lure young women who would emphasize, you know, this is an Islamic paradise. It's also pure. It's also friendly. And the fighters are out there and they don't care about material goods. They just care about piety and living a good Islamic life. It was very much a kind of pioneer, kind of come to the new world kind
of
pitch.
Yeah, this is
kind of
what we're now calling on social media trad wife stuff, right?
Right. Have you exactly
heard
this expression?
Yes. Traditional yes. wife, this trad culture. So, yeah. I mean, not to be diminishing of the seriousness of this situation that we're describing, but yeah, it was pretty amazing to read, as if these guys were sort of sleeping out there. They were all alone. They needed the comforts of a good woman. That was kind of my reading of it.
Exactly.
And there would be something seductive about that to a teenage girl who's just kind of, you know, spending her days at the mall, immersed in kind of cheap material culture.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, analysts have looked at kind of the nervous middle classes who have relatively recently become very serious about their Islam. And, you know, the sense of that there's a kind of brittle identity there. And the idea of committing to this wholeheartedly sounds very appealing. In Afifa's case, a lot of it comes down to, as her sister said, work-life balance. You know, the notion of her father was a workaholic in you know, climbing the ranks of the civil service, and she wanted more time with him. So, you know, she would ask a recruiter, you know, can my father get a job over there? And they were like, of course. And if he doesn't want to work, he can even do that. You know, they would drip whatever she wanted to hear into mm-hmm. her ear. And it wasn't just Afifa, it was also her uncle. But in the end, it was 26 members of this extended family going for all sorts of different reasons, ranging in age from a 2-year-old toddler to a grandmother in her 80s, and, you know, struggling across the border from Turkey into Syria. And they quickly became disillusioned when they saw it up close and personal, which is a very common trajectory, I think, once you make it to the jihad, the cold, hard reality of it often.
Right. And so I may have misspoken. Were they living in Turkey? I thought they were in Indonesia for some
reason. No, I'm sorry. They were in, you were absolutely right. They were in Indonesia. They lived in Java. in a town and in Java, and then flew to Turkey.
Okay.
Did some sightseeing before they drove to the border at Kellis. Got to get that in. You got to see the Blue Mosque. And then they hired some smugglers and climbed over fences and walked for hours. And when they reached the Islamic State, Afifa, you know, fell to her knees and kissed the earth.
Okay, so when you say when they reached the Islamic State, what does that look like? Like, there is somebody there to greet them? The person who brought them over, is that person part of the hard sell? Like, I just want to get my mind around this scenario. Like, they just sort of, they sell their house, they go en masse. What are they thinking all of this time, and how quickly do they become disillusioned?
They were thinking, you know, a variety of things when they went. They had this, you know, one aunt had an autistic child that she wanted medical care for. One, you know, the grandmother very much hoped to die in blessed Shams, in blessed Syria, thinking mm-hmm. that is. So they all have these hopes and dreams. There are smugglers that you can contact, and certainly the recruiters make that very easy for you when you get to the Turkish-Syrian border. And they had to break up into smaller groups. And, you know, the 84-year-old grandmother ripped her leg as they were climbing over a barbed wire yeah. fence. And, you know, and the smugglers take them and they say here. And then in their account, three or four men from the Islamic State said, "You are now in our territory." They took them to a safe house where they rested, changed clothes. Afifa, being 16 or 17 at the time, was very excited about changing into a burqa.
Wow.
And so you are there, and then you're, in their case, they were taken to Raqqa, which was sort of the main town in the Islamic State.
Right. How was she sort of presenting herself as a teenage female before this? We talked about going to the mall sort of euphemistically, but when you just said she was very excited about putting on a burqa, that really kind of hit me. Like, was she wanting to get away from a kind of secular culture that felt scary to her or exploitive? What was appealing to her, to women? Let's just start off with her, and then I want to talk about what's appealing about this to various kinds of people. But in the case of Afifa.
In the case of Afifa, it's clear she is very, very bright and very, very headstrong. And, you know, when she was a young teenager, she started reading accounts of the Prophet's life, which in, you know, Islamic tradition, there are biographies of the Prophet that paint the early days of Islam as rather marvelous, as, you know, it's a young community and they're all working together, and, you know, it can be very romantic, and especially romantic when you're in this kind of halfway house in terms of, you know, are you suburban? Are you not? So this idea of wanting an Islamic identity became increasingly important to her. But it was mixed up with these very, you know, ordinary, you know, desires. You know, guess what? We can go to med school for free, she tells her sister.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So amazing. It's not, I don't think it was a running away from secularism. It was more idealism in a way. It was more just, let's get away from it all. Which is, you know, and Nicola actually talks about this too. She says, look, we are living in a time when so many people are looking for their identities, are looking for a simpler, you know, gentler way of life. Then the Islamic State comes along and says, look, we can build something new together, something fresh together, something new, but also something that harkens back to the days that we've always been told are the most beautiful days in Islam, the days of the Prophet Muhammad. That's a pretty seductive potion right there.
In the case of Nicola's son, Rashid, for instance, he had, I believe it was a Moroccan father. She was a convert. She was from Wales. Was there a sense when you were talking to her that Rashid felt like he was the target of racism, of Islamophobia, that his skin color perhaps was making him particularly vulnerable to this kind of recruitment? Like, how much does just plain old racism and skin color, let's just face it, factor into this?
In Rashid's case, that wasn't it. The recruiters exploited his parents' temporary separation and, you know, nostalgia for going back to a simpler way of life. But it wasn't racism in his case. I did talk to other families and other former militants who absolutely felt racism was a big factor. The son of one of the Belgian women I talked to basically got to the age of 18, and though he, you know, spoke Arabic, French, and a couple other languages, could not get a job interview and was just like, there is no future for me here. I'm heading for Syria. It's very common. And I think, you know, it varies widely from country to country, but you know, in countries like France, Germany, there has been a real, you know, difficult relationship with immigrants. And there's no myth of being an immigrant nation that we have in the United States to fall back on. Certainly in France, it's been an incredibly clumsy and quite securitized reaction to Islamist terror. And of course, they've had major, major tragic attacks, but that their solution to it has been, you know, okay, we're going to make these guys French, which doesn't work.
Right. So it's assimilationist rather than integration.
Exactly.
With these guys, okay, let's just go back to Afifa's family for starters, because I'm so fascinated by them. Okay, so there's men of different generations in this family. Did any or all of them or any, did any of them think they were actually going to go fight and like brutally kill people? What did they think was going to happen once they joined this group?
Well, Afifa had sold her father on going to have an office job if he wanted one. You know, a recruiter had assured her that he'll make much more money, and if he doesn't want to work, he won't have to work. So, no, they did not think of themselves as fighting. They literally thought that they were going to go and, you know, build a suburban home in this new paradise. The parents, I'm fascinated by the parents. I interviewed the mother. The father was in jail. And, you know, I kept pressing her. I kept saying, you know, what were you thinking? You know, I even tried to kind of say, you know, I understand what it's like to have a very, very headstrong kid. And, you know, if you're pretty easygoing, you know, and she kept, they were terrified that Afifa would run away, because she had run away for a little, you know, a couple of days, just decided, if my parents won't agree to going to the Islamic State, I'm going to find a way there myself.
Did she have mental health issues, or did they perceive her to be so fragile that they needed to sort of do anything they could to save their kid? Because I thought that was a great moment where you say parents who feel that they're child is in crisis will do anything to save their child. But it doesn't even sound like it was that extreme for this family at this point.
Not at all. I mean, she was at the top of her class. She was very insistent, and you got the sense that the other folks in her family were more laissez-faire, as it were. And she got fixated on this, but I wouldn't say mental illness. And indeed, when you look at people who join terrorist groups, they tend to have no more mental illness than other, you know, other populations. But in Afifa's case, it was that she ran away for a couple of days, or not even, like overnight and ended up hiding at a teacher's house, and they found her. And she said, I really, really want to do this. And it took a little more time. And I have to say, an uncle was also pressing for this in terms of the wider group. So it wasn't okay. Afifa alone.
This is a lot of credence and power given to a
16-year-old.
A young girl.
Yeah.
Yes. So
absolutely.
That would go against many of our assumptions. Okay. Well, once they got there, did any of the men in the family actually take up arms? You say the father is in jail. Is that just by virtue of him having gone there in the first place, or did he actually commit violence?
According to Afifa, it's very, very hard to figure out, and this is one of the difficulties with prosecuting people when they come home. It's very hard to figure out what people did and didn't do. I mean, radicalization experts and terror experts say that, suddenly the Islamic State had like thousands of bus drivers because everybody comes out and claims they just drove buses. They didn't go into battle. But it seems that
that's the cover. That's the go-to.
That's
cover.
What you say. Yeah. I drove a bus or, I mended shoes or something. Because of course there will be very different consequences in the country you're returned to. But no, the two men, I believe, according to Afifa, were brought into military training but didn't fight. And actually during the process of Afifa and her and the women's sort of disillusionment with the Islamic State, in part came about when they saw up close and personal just how horrible everybody was to each other. And one of the things, when a policeman comes to their house to talk to them, said, "You've never given anything to the Islamic State. Your men didn't even fight." So I don't think they did fight, but I can't confirm that.
And the way you describe where they're living and the people they're with, it really just sounds like the dormitory from hell. Like these people are rude. They're unclean, at least in the men's quarters. Like they're not washing their clothes. They're not showering. It's just this like really kind of revolting free for all. And again, I just want to understand the kind of infrastructure here. And I think most people probably are equally befuddled. It's like, is there a campus? Are there training grounds? Are they going to classes? Like, what does this place consist of?
I mean, they're in a town. I mean, Raqqa.
Okay, they're in Raqqa. So
yeah,
it basically functions. All of Raqqa's mission is to train jihadis. Is that fair to say?
No, I mean it was part of the Islamic State. So it's an ordinary town that has been taken over. So I believe the men were in training camps and the women got taken to this, as you say, the dormitory from hell, where everybody was very quarrelsome. And as Afifa's sister said, some of them seemed to have anger issues, such as, fighting with knives in the kitchen and screaming at each other.
Understatement of the year.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. She's very diplomatic. But so they initially were moved to this dorm and then I think they got their own house. But yeah, I mean, that's another thing. It's not as though this is a giant, training camp or battlefield. It is, there was normalcy. They would go to the markets and look for used clothes. They would go try to look for smugglers to take them out. So, I'm not downplaying, the fear they must have felt, but, there was a modicum of normal life. They would go to the bazaar and be screamed at by the, police for not having their double veils over their faces and so
right.
on.
Did Afifa ever talk about her feelings about the veil and the burqa as time went on? I mean, was the double veil a bridge too far, or did she continue to find a kind of power or novelty in that?
I don't know. We didn't talk about it. I mean, she did say, when I started to realize that this was not the Islamic paradise I had imagined was when I was at the bazaar one day and I had one of my veils flipped up, and they came and yelled at me really loudly as though I had done something terrible. And she said, you know, that was sort of one of the first kind of inklings that this was not all that it appeared to be. And those kind of cracks in reality are a real, that is a theme you see throughout former extremists' tales, where suddenly up close, they see the writing on the wall, and it's like, wait, you know. And her family went through a whole disillusionment period, but it still, you know, they were there for 18 months. So it took them a while to escape in a sort of, you know, classic across a boat being shot at, waving a white flag, escape scene.
And what had happened with their money? Had they given it to the Islamic State? Like, they sold their house. What did they do with that money?
They used it to pay smugglers. They, you know, and they used it. Yeah, I think that is essentially what they did. And then used it to get back. When I visited the women of the family, I guess about a, you know, less than a year after they got out, they were living in very humble circumstances, and were, you know, Afifa had all sorts of ideas about, you know, starting an, first she wanted to make cloth purses and sell them on the internet. So, you know, they would have to make money.
Speaking of what goes on in these training camps, what these men end up being trained to do and actually doing, you attended a conference, I guess, a convention, I don't know what the word would be, of former ISIS fighters, former Islamic extremist fighters in Jakarta. And there were a number of interesting characters there. Tell us about that particular business trip.
The conference was pretty extraordinary. It was the brainchild of this guy, Huda Noor Ismail, who runs an NGO for former jihadis in Indonesia. And he, you know, I started off the trip. He was like, well, come, there's still room in the hotel. You know, we have 20 jihadis staying here, but yeah, I think there's still some room. And I was like,
like, would you like to be on a high floor?
And I was like, I couldn't get up the guy. I was like, you know, I'm going to stay next door and I'll walk to the conference, because among their number were guys who had actually, you know, blown up high rise hotels or been involved in plots to blow up high rise hotels. So I decided to stay next door. But it was, his idea is that mixing people up, that one of the problems is that jihadis will, you know, go to war, then come back, and they're stuck in the same networks. So Noor's idea is, you know, get them meeting other kinds of people. Get them, so, and these are guys, you know, they'd all pretty much done time in prison, and there were four generations of them. Noor had, you know, we had a conference with absolutely, you know, all the classic conference trappings. You know, we had swag bags with a big logo saying "Bridging Without Prejudice" across it, and we had pens and paper. And Huda would run around with his microphone. He opened the conference saying, "You know, we've got four generations of jihadis here today." And, you know, the first generation was the, you know, somebody, a gray beard who had gone to Afghanistan to fight with the Mujahideen back in the 80s. And then there were people from, you know, the Philippines who had gone to fight in the Philippines and so on. And then the youngest and kind of the star of the show was Afifa, who we've just been discussing, and her family. And, you know, they're just back from the Islamic State. They're going to. And the idea was, he had invited filmmakers, he had invited a woman who instructed people on how to give TEDx-style talks, how to tell your story. videographers, entrepreneurs, businessmen to do workshops so that these guys could see a way forward.
After. So the only way out of this lifestyle is to become a sort of influencer, TED talker type.
Well, that
there's
was
nothing more of the moment than that.
It was, you know, when we were sitting there and we had to do these exercises and turn to the person next to you and tell them your life story with, you know, the requisite pivot point and the requisite, you know, message that you wanted to give at the end. It was surreal. Yeah, absolutely. But his idea, I mean, in part, this is his theory is that the more you share the disillusionment that you find when you actually go to jihad and you tell people about, you know, the reality behind the battle, it is actually a preventative for other people who might have the same sort of shiny eyed idealism that we saw in Afifa. So that's telling their stories, and the government in Indonesia regularly kind of puts former jihadis on TV and has them tell their stories so that people can see that it's not all it's cracked up to be.
Okay, but there were some people there who were pretty scary. So tell us about a couple of those, possibly one in particular.
You know, I felt like, you know, I was like, I'm here to listen. I'm here to, and I did feel like, you know, okay, I'm beginning to understand why this one guy went, because he thought he was joining an NGO and it turned out to be an armed NGO. And this other guy who was, you know, had just loved guns all his life and joined. But there was one person, and this was, you know, the normal conference where you're supposed to be having lunch with people and chatting to them over tea in the afternoon and mingling. But there was, on the first day, my translator leaned over to me and she's like, "See that guy over there?" And he looked like everybody else. And of course, this guy had been convicted very publicly of beheading two Christian schoolgirls. Teenagers, exactly the ages of my own daughters. And this was in a Christian Muslim sectarian kind of battle in Indonesia, in a particular region of Indonesia. And he had been, you know, it was very brutal and very awful. And she's like, "Yeah, he's out of prison." And for the conference, I could not bring myself to go up and talk to him, and kind of avoided him, even though he, you know, would be in front of me in the coffee line or whatever. And on the last day of the conference, I was waiting for the elevator, and who should show up next to me with no one else around but the man that I had in my own head begun calling the beheader. And, you know, we exchanged platitudes, you know, how do you enjoy Indonesia? And I'm feeling super shaky at this point. And I was like, you know, if I were really doing my job as a journalist, I would sit down with him and ask him his story, because I'm sure there's a story there. But I kind of hit my bedrock there. And, you know, all my, like, let's exercise our empathy muscles just kind of gave out and felt like jelly instead.
Well, I mean, that's a big ask for anybody to maintain any kind of composure around this guy. I mean, it's extraordinary that he's walking around this conference. People are standing behind him in the coffee line. People are talking with him. Was he somebody who had been brought in as a speaker? Was his rehabilitation process an example to be cited? What was his role there?
He was one of the, you know, one of the jihadis. There were sort of, you know, 20, he was just a participant. He wasn't cited specially, you know, and, you know, he was just an ordinary guy by this time, you know, that people, he now teaches at an Islamic boarding school.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know.
Wait. This guy beheaded two schoolgirls, and he's not only not in prison anymore, he's teaching at a school?
That is what I heard. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So your job as somebody who knows a lot about the Muslim world, whatever that means, and I know that doesn't mean much because it's so incredibly broad, but what do you say to the person who says, and I think understandably, I cannot get my mind around that kind of scenario. I can't get my mind around any kind of culture, any quote unquote religion, belief system, tradition that would give a pass to any scenario in which that kind of thing could happen. I mean, how do you process that?
I would never condone something like that, certainly something that he did. But I would also really urge people not to connect it to a particular religion, not to connect it to a particular culture even. You know, I can't speak for what Indonesian jail sentences are in the Indonesian penal code. And in this case, I obviously sort of hit my dead end in terms of trying to understand or trying to, you know, I've ranted and raved against people who just use evil as a kind of blunting tool, not to ask why people do things. And in this case, I sort of failed to explore it. But do I condemn what he did? Obviously.
This Is Monsters is a true crime podcast and YouTube channel where I tell the stories of the worst people on the planet. Though the stories of the victims are told, we focus on the monster who carried out the evil act. The show is split into seasons, and each season has a theme. In season 1, we covered cases of filicide, which is the act of a parent killing their own child. In season 2, we covered cases of people killing for love. We recently finished up season 3, where we covered cases of parricide, which is the act of someone killing their parents. Tune in now as we start season 4, where we dive into the minds of family annihilators. Sick individuals who decided to destroy their entire families. Check us out anywhere that you listen to podcasts or on YouTube by searching This Is Monsters.
Well, I'm sure you run into this question all the time. What do you say about the fact? I mean, it appears to be a fact that this kind of crime, this kind of killing, beheading of children, is something that is more often done in the name of Islam than in a Judeo-Christian tradition or, God knows, Hinduism, Buddhism. Why is this kind of violence connected to Islam?
One of the things that I really want to argue, I want to work away from is this is not linked to Islam. As you unpick these terrorist horrors, they are much closer to power politics, to local skirmishes, to other, they are not ideological, and they certainly aren't prescribed by Islam. I do think that the Islamic State in particular used a particular strategy which paraded savagery. I mean, that was by design, and we heard a lot of horror stories. But I would also urge people to think about what is much less reported. It's not linked to Judeo-Christianity, but it is linked to, you know, our power, which is, you know, we drop bombs on civilians in the Middle East. It doesn't get reported. And, you know, we drop bombs on wedding parties in, you know, northern Pakistan, and it merits a tiny news item. I don't think this has to do with Islam. I think it has to do with power and cultures of violence that come out of particular local situations.
That said, these extremists are purporting that they are enforcing these codes in the name of Islam. Whether or not it has to do with Islam as it's broadly defined or as you experience it, the fact is that these tribal traditions, these kinds of what we would see as completely uncivilized, quote unquote, ways of maintaining some kind of society, those have been linked by the very people who are enforcing them to Islam. So what do you say about the fact that it is in Islamic countries where the clock is being turned back when it comes to norms of what it means to be a civilized society? I mean, we know all too well that as recently as the 70s, countries like Egypt and Iran were functioning much like Western societies, at least in cities. You know, women were going out to discos, people were sitting in cafes and drinking, and there was a secular culture. And obviously why and when all of that started to change is a different conversation. But I'm sure that as somebody who is a scholar in a lot of these issues and somebody who's been reporting about the Islamic world and the Middle East for decades, you know these details intimately. So I hate to say, what is your short answer to this? But you must come up against this all the time. Like, why is it that we are seeing this kind of repression and enforcement of really, really sort of just, I hate to say backwards, but I will, you know, girls can't go to school, women can't go out of their houses. There are honor killings. Yes, those things are taking place in very small, rural, kind of backwater communities. That doesn't represent mainstream Islam, but there is not a sort of Judeo-Christian, for example, version of it. So how do you
there certainly are Judeo-Christian version, or, you know, there's certainly a Christian version
of not letting girls go to school.
We just limiting the rights of women. It's not the same as in Afghanistan. Yeah, look, what you have in, you know, I hate to make any generalizations, but take, for example, the Taliban and they're not wanting to go. That is not necessarily, you know, it is an interpretation of Islamic principles that have to do with a very localized Pashtun, one particular right. group in Afghanistan, interpretation of culture you know, culture and religion get marbled together over time. And, you know, that is their interpretation of Islam. It's a very particular one. But what has happened more globally and why you are seeing is a combination of things. You are seeing the export by the Saudis since the 70s of their form, Wahhabi Islam, which kind of ground down and blotted out much more, you know, you ground down the Sufi tradition, you ground down much more quietist and flexible manifestations of Islamic cultures. And you had the Saudis literally exporting people and schools and Qurans with particular, you know, particular translations that conform to the high-bound Saudi way. And you also, at the same time, get groups in places like Iran and Egypt who were living under American-backed dictators, effectively, you know, who were stifling political speech. And one of the few ways that you had to get a local movement together is to speak in an Islamic language, to speak using the culture and the faith that you all shared. And so often resistance to anti-democratic forces, you know, whether it's the Shah in Iran or various leaders in Egypt, would take on an Islamic tinge. And this, some groups got more and more, radical as that went on. That's a much bigger story. But I do think that there is a conflagration of political, local tradition, sort of local geopolitics, and also a sense of a stifling of sort of the kinder, gentler, more educated traditions, thanks to the Saudi export of Wahhabi, ideology.
Yeah. So speaking of the 70s, you spent a lot of time in the Middle East as a kid growing up. You talk a lot in both of your books about the affinity that your father had for that part of the world. You write really movingly about how he struggled with depression and coming to countries like, I think you were in, well, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. I know you were in Afghanistan a few times. Your family spent a lot of time in India. You grew up in the Midwest and the Mideast. So you grew up in St. Louis. Your mother was a college professor. Was your father an academic as well?
Yeah, he was a law professor.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so did they have particular academic interests in the Middle East, or did they just like it?
My dad was a law professor with a passing interest in Islamic law. But I think what really drove him was he suffered with lifelong depression, and he felt better when he was abroad. He wasn't such an eccentric when he was overseas. He was just, an American kind of thing, and could, he really delved into learning the language, and, every week would go, say, to the bazaar and come back with a rug. He was aesthetically entranced by it, as so many Westerners were at that time. Particularly in Afghanistan, you talk to people. I remember after 9/11, reading the accounts of Americans who had been there before the Soviets invaded, and you'll get these, suburban housewives saying, "I just sometimes pull over my car, and I think of the blue of the Kabul sky, and I just have to sit there and think of it." So certainly Afghanistan was quite a special place. But yeah, my dad was there to help in Kabul, to help the Minister of Justice incorporate tribal law into a modern constitution. He was a Fulbright fellow there helping out. And I've been thinking a lot about him over these past few weeks, because of course,
it
did not work out.
So when did you first go there? Were you like in elementary school? What was it like? I really just want to know what it was like. Were you going to like a public school in St. Louis, and then your parents said, "Oh, we're going here. You're going to have to
pretty much." Adjust. Yeah. Yeah. They were not shy about picking us up at a moment, relatively short notice, and going off. And we did this, sort of every couple of years. And we went. And of course, I mean, the great irony was that as an 11-year-old, I lived a much more American life in Kabul in 1978 than I did back in St. Louis. We had a house that, if you squinted, looked like it was out of suburban California. And we had a dog, and, we would go to football games in every weekend, because there was this kind of, edifice of American life that the 300 Americans there had constructed. And my parents, were wanderers, but they knew they wanted to keep some sort of continuity.
And you were speaking English? You were living in a kind of expat community?
I mean, I went to the American International School of Kabul, and where there were cheerleaders and Sadie Hawkins dances and so on. And it was a really odd kind of Laura Ingalls Wilder kind of experience, because you hoarded these bits of Americana there. I remember, you know, when the local American commissary got bubble yum, and I would only allow myself like half a piece of bubble yum.
Well, half a piece of bubble yum is already the size of a stick of butter. So
exactly. No, it was a very strange edifice. And then, of course, you know, we were living a two-time. We were part of the, you know, an imperial project. We were sort of perched on top of Afghanistan, in a questionable way, I would say, at that point.
I want to circle back to Afghanistan in a minute, but just I want to make sure before we conclude our conversation that you say everything you might have to say in terms of what you've learned about the psychology of this. I mean, I know we don't want to draw any generalizations, but I was really struck by all the parents that you spoke with, the formers, so to speak, the people who came back from this kind of indoctrination. It sounded in many cases a lot, and I said this at the beginning, like people who talk about having been deprogrammed from a cult. They talk about why they were drawn into this kind of organization or group. And a lot of it comes out of feelings of loneliness, or that they don't really have something to attach their identity to. I mean, we've skipped over a lot. You also speak to Americans, somebody in Minneapolis, for instance, who've become radicalized into Islamic extremism. I mean, this is really, you literally take us all over the map. But do you, having done all this research, have insights into the quote unquote cult mentality, to use a reductive term, that you didn't before you started this?
Yeah. I mean, I do think it is, you know, at its baseline, radicalization is a kind of whittling away of the ability to see other guys' points of view. And kind of moving towards a certainty that you didn't have beforehand. And that certainty is something that, you know, a lot of people are seeking at times like this. So I would definitely, I can see the attraction of it. You know, and it's funny, I during the pandemic, which apparently has been boom time for white supremacist recruiters on the internet. You've got a captive audience of kids who are bored at home, and increasingly, you know, if they've been in lockdowns, as we have been here, have nothing to do and want some sort of, you know, want some sort of community, want some sort of reach out. You know, experts are saying it's kind of a perfect storm for recruiters. So I do think, in a way, I'm looking at how people are desperate for connections, certainly in the West. I think I should say that there are all sorts of other reasons, you know, political and social, that folks outside Western societies might join, and that's it. That's another reason. But certainly, the sense of wanting some sort of purity and certainty is something that afflicted even, you know, most of us, I would suspect, during the pandemic. I mean, I found myself, you know, seeing a news story about, you know, Tuscan hillsides being sold for, you know, a euro, and plotting my escape to purity and certainty. You know, we'd grow organic vegetables and, you know, teach our own kids and whatever. I'm not making light of this. I actually think that one thing that recruiters prey on are very human things that are present in all of us. And I think the best programs and people working in this recognize the possibility for all of us to be radicalized given the right circumstances.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I want to make sure we touch on your research in Denmark. You go to a town called Aarhus. Am I pronouncing Aarhus, that?
Yeah.
Aarhus.
Yeah.
It's a town in Denmark that seems to have an especially humane and innovative approach to rehabilitation. You meet a guy named Thorleif Link, who's a detective. What is it about his approach, besides the fact that I think that he's allowed to work with like one person for years at a time? It's a one-on-one kind of mentorship. What are they doing differently there?
The critics of Aarhus is quite famous in terms of de-radicalization circle, and its critics call it a hug a terrorist approach because
oh, I thought that was going to be like a religion, like I'm a hugitarian, but I see yes.
Hug a terrorist.
I'm a hugitarian. Yes, a hug no. a terrorist. Yes, okay.
And you know, they set up this program where, as Thorleif calls it, you know. People who were worried about radicalizing, or indeed during the Islamic State, who were coming back from the Islamic State, could drop by what he calls the Little Yellow House, which was sort of like an IKEA setup with coffee cups and, you know, stripped pine tables and so on. And you drop in and have a cup of coffee. And their idea was, look, you know, we need to keep talking to these people, and we need to help them on their routes out of this. So if that means finding you a job, finding you an apartment, finding you a psychologist, Thorleif worked with somebody who wanted to be a journalist, and he came out of prison, and you need to take an exam to become a journalist in Denmark. And so Thorleif went and got a journalist who agreed to tutor this guy. And, you know, they worked together. So it's very hands-on. It's very labor intensive, and it can last years. It also like pivots on the fact of a welfare state. This is Scandinavia yeah. at its most kind of fairy tale support system network, where it's like, sure, we can help you. Now I should say that I think that there's an interesting kind of intrusion of the state into, you know, like they know everything about you. If you've, you know, had a fight with your neighbor, or if you, you know, got expelled from school, there is a database that keeps all this stuff together. So the systems were in place for, you know, the police in Aarhus to set this up so that they could. So, you know, none of these programs I'm saying can be grafted onto American culture or, you know, Indonesian culture. You have to stay local. But Aarhus was fascinating in the resources they poured into these returning ISIS fighters.
Yeah, you do make the point that obviously this is particular to the political DNA of a country like Denmark. But I think it's worth remembering that the mentorship piece was very much in place in Minneapolis, I think, right? They found a guy who was a teacher who, I can't remember what he was of Muslim heritage.
He was first generation Somali
right.
American. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but the interesting thing about the Minneapolis case, and it was fascinating, you know, here was a young man who had become interested in going to the Islamic State, tried to go to the airport, is apprehended, and then later ends up in prison for it. And, you know, this was a one-off, and this was something that was set up by three very energetic individuals with the blessing of the judge in the case, who sort of right. took a risk. And these, you know, three people working pro bono, and Ahmed Amin, who's this extraordinary, charismatic Minneapolis high school teacher and debate coach, who took on Abdullahi, and, you know, basically gave him a civics class, but a civics class with a reading list ranging from David Foster Wallace to Malcolm X to, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates. And they sat down in the prison cell and had discussions about identity and what does it mean for Abdullahi to be a part of the American project and what does it mean to be a Black man in America. And this, you know, this was a painstaking thing, but there was no money. And it was done through a really extraordinary bunch of people who there's no structure there.
Right. Yeah. This is always the case in America.
Lucky. Yeah.
They'll end up making a movie about it, but it's not part of any kind of systematic approach. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. It's just a very
heartwarming
lucky
story.
Yes. Exactly.
And, yeah. Your book was obviously timed to come out around the 20th anniversary of 9/11. As it happens, it's also coincided with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Taliban's immediate regain of control. I know you're not an expert on Afghanistan, even though you did live there a few times as a child. But I'm wondering, Carla, based on your reporting for this book and all the years you've spent covering that region, if you have any thoughts about this supposedly, if not kinder, gentler Taliban, supposedly more reasonable, modern Taliban. Is anyone who falls for this being duped?
I think the really important thing with the Taliban is something that we didn't necessarily seem to really, really focus on over the last 20 years, which is that there are Taliban and Taliban. There's talk now of there's a moderate flank and there's a much more didactic hardcore flank. And it sounds like the hardcore flank may win out. But, you know, again, my hope is that they're going to have to be realistic. But I don't, you know, there has been an amazing myopia on our part in terms of what constitutes the Taliban. You know, we talk about them as though they're their single entity. And of course they're not. They're fluid, they're networked. You know, you go which way the wind blows at this point. So I think we've got to be really clear that we don't necessarily know who we're dealing with yet.
Well, Carla, thank you so much for taking all this time to talk with me, and congratulations on the book, Home, comma, Land, comma, Security, De-Radicalization and the Journey Back from Extremism. It's really, it's such a thorough piece of reporting, and you take on a lot of complexities with a lot of humanity, and just it's very accessible. Also, so
good. I'm glad it's accessible. That's I don't want people to think it's a kind of, you know, Henry Kissinger advice tone. Rather, it is just
I would never have Henry Kissinger on this show.
I'm sure you wouldn't.
I actually might have Henry Kissinger on the show. In any case, that was my interview with Carla Power. She is a former reporter for Newsweek and the author of a new book, Home, Land, Security, De-Radicalization and the Journey Back from Extremism. Her previous book is If the Oceans Were Ink, An Unlikely Friendship and Journey into the Heart of the Quran, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. She lives in the United Kingdom. You've been listening to the Unspeakable Podcast. This podcast now has a YouTube channel. Thank goodness. It's called the Unspeakable Channel, and it's where you can find video interviews under the new Unspeakeasy imprimatur. These are informal conversations I'm having with various people, mostly unconnected to the podcast. You can watch part of them on the channel, and if you want to watch the rest, you can join the Patreon at patreon.com/theunspeakable. There you can get lots of perks, including ad-free early access editions of the podcast, discounts on official nuanced AF merchandise, and access to a new feature, regular Zoom hangouts where listeners get together with me to talk about specific episodes of the podcast. These happen pretty much every other Sunday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. and they're really a lot of fun. So please join us if you're so inclined. And even if you're not inclined, your Patreon support really, really helps me, especially as I try to expand this enterprise with all these new features. I'm really grateful for listener support. That's it for now. I'll be back next week with another super nuanced guest, maybe two guests in the same show. Until then, thanks for listening. See you next time.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.